Oh, one of them is just like an article about him, kinda.
Yeah, I wanted to read it, but it was TLDR, so I'll have to do it later.
What does that mean?
Too long, didn't read.
It took you longer to say that, and then you knew you were gonna have to explain it. You knew it. You knew it when you said it.
Just because you're old.
We're the same age. You're older than me.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. With me again from San Diego, California, is co-host Keith Foster.
That's right. Welcome to the documentation of the before world, before the end times, before the boom times happened and the sad clouds rained away our civilization. I'm talking about the end of the world, which is coming up pretty soon, and I'm here with Cassidy Robinson from L.A.
Mm-hmm. So you're starting on a low note.
Yeah, so, it's just, I don't know, it's been a stressful day.
Yeah, you know, it's just life in this reality, and in the Berenstein's reality that happened.
Oh, man, I know. I wonder
somehow
what's
got
going
wormholed
on
into the...
This is the darkest timeline.
Right, yeah. Biff yeah. World.
I was referencing Community.
I don't know things.
Either way.
I don't know things about TV. However, and I was actually saving this for the top of the show, I did start watching a show, and I wanted to ask you about it.
Was it
no.
Game of Thrones?
No, it's not Game of Thrones.
God damn
it. I'm not going to start Game of Thrones 7 seasons in.
You're fucking waste.
I know, it's a character flaw, according to you. No, I started watching that show Ozark on Netflix, because there's
Oh, no, I don't care. I don't care.
You know that it's a thing, though?
I've heard of it.
No, the only reason that I started watching Ozark is because, I was sort of curious to see Jason Bateman trying again, because he hasn't done that in a long time. He's been pretty much coasting on the goodwill of Arrested Development for like the past 12 years.
Yeah.
And so I saw that like, oh, he's like actually in something vaguely serious. Okay. And Laura Linney's in it and she's cool. And then also there's being in LA and it being a thing that's new. There's billboards about every 20 feet and bus ads. For this new show. So I was like, okay, fine. And then I heard somebody on a podcast I listened to recommend it. So I started it. And it's... So you haven't watched it at all?
You are an insane person. You were... Like, you are literally missing out on the most important pop culture show of all time.
Meh.
And you're like, Ozark is all right.
I'm three episodes in. I'm vaguely invested. I'm not going to say anything new about it that nobody's already said online, which is basically it's a mini Breaking Bad. It's very similar. It's about a guy who's trying to like launder money for these like dangerous gangsters, and he uproots his family and moves to the Ozarks. So it's kind of like a fish out of water thing, because they're also like Chicago natives, and then they go and move into the middle of the woods with all these hillbillies. But it's, I don't know, it's kind of weird. It's almost like they know they're so similar to Breaking Bad that they try really hard not to be in the most vital places. So like from the beginning of the show, basically, everybody in the family knows what he's doing. And then you're like, oh man, well, what if, I guess the tension's going to be if the police find out. They already know. Everybody knows everything from like episode 2. So I'm like, I don't really know how there's going to be a show, but okay.
I guess.
I vaguely recommend it. It looks pretty.
You know what I highly recommend?
What?
Game of Thrones.
You don't say.
It's insane that you don't watch it.
I don't know if I've ever talked about my lack of interest in Game of Thrones. Partly it's because it's such a pop culture phenomenon right now that
that is so not a reason, especially when you run a pop culture podcast.
Eh.
That is like the snobbiest.
It's not a snobby thing. It's like, oh, I don't want to like it because everybody else likes it. It's like being jammed down my throat. Like, it's literally being jammed down my throat. Like, I think of it very... When it's Game of Thrones season, I feel the same way as when it's football season, and I just see 1,000 memes and 1,000 things on my Facebook feed about Game of Thrones. And everybody's talking about how the last episode was so fucking crazy, because every episode is so fucking crazy.
Yeah, because every episode's so fucking crazy. Like, why?
I just, like, physically can't care. I'm sure it's great. I'll take it as a failing on my part. It's my problem that I don't like Game of Thrones, or that I don't care enough about it to have an opinion either way.
You haven't tried. Okay, here's the thing.
I watched three or so episodes.
That's not trying.
Here's the thing, though. This is what would happen. If I said, okay, I'll watch Game of Thrones season one, I'll start it, and I got through the entire season and was like, it's okay, it's just not really my thing, you and everybody else would be like, dude, just give it another season. It takes like 2 seasons. And then I'd be like, all right. Okay. And then I'd watch 2, and I'd be like, I'm still just not really feeling it. And they'd be like, well, how far are you? I'm like, I don't know, 3 seasons. They'd be like, dude, the show doesn't even get started till like season 6.
No. Okay. Let me rebut you. Okay, I will say the first season, if you don't have some kind of a cipher, it is dense. So I can get how it's hard to get into the first season. I get that, right? If by the end of season 2 you're not feeling it, it's not for you. Like, I guarantee by the end of season 2,
that's the hook. That's where it's at.
It's
20 episodes in.
I mean, really, it's like the first 5 minutes. If that doesn't like get you, then okay, I guess. But it's just you're literally missing out a pop culture phenomenon. Like, when people talk about like the 2010s.
I've missed out on a lot of pop culture phenomenons. I never watched Dallas.
That's not the same. It's literally changing the way they make television and movies, this show.
Well, judging from all of the directors and / actors who've went on from Game of Thrones to do things, I can't say it's changing movies for the better.
I would say it's whatever. This is the Game world of Thrones
need
podcast.
Kit Harington. That's all I'm saying. Does the world need Kit Harington?
You know what? No, you cannot shoot shade at my beautiful Jon Snow if you ain't watching GOT.
Yes, I can, because I saw, what was that fucking volcano movie?
I don't give a fuck. Give me any actor, and they have a version of the volcano movie. Any actor. Name one.
I'm okay. Right. Okay, so that we devoted the beginning of the show with you chastising me for not watching Game of Thrones.
As you should be publicly shamed until you watch it.
Mm-hmm. With shame. The bell and all of that.
Shame.
Yeah. See, you would get that reference. Things.
You don't.
I know the things.
You don't know.
There's the red wedding, the purple wedding, the green wedding. There's all the weddings. Okay. But there's today we're actually going to be reviewing Atomic Blonde.
All I will say is get into Rick and Morty now while it's like early in the third season.
Oh, okay. Here's the part where I'm going to alienate everybody from listening to the podcast. Started Rick and Morty, six episodes in. It's okay. I get it. I get why people like it. I think it's a little like a little dirtier version of Futurama. But I also, that's another one of those ones where it's like season 2. That's where it's at.
Did you get to the Purge World episode?
Yeah, there was some fun ones. I really like the Inception-y one where they run into like a like an analog of Freddy Krueger. That was fun. And the Mr. Meese, like, I get it. It's fun. It's also on Hulu, and Hulu is like a pain in the bitch to watch.
Yeah, fuck Hulu.
Like, it's anyway. The worst. Anyway, okay, so we're going to review Atomic Blonde. At the end of the program, we're going to get to that Netflix homework that you assigned me 20 years ago. That yes. documentary, Accidental Courtesy?
Yes.
Yes. And we got a few things lined up, including movie news. So let's start with that.
Yes. I believe you play a sound graphic here.
Movie news. Talking about that movie news.
Okay, Gerard Way and Gabriel Baugh's The Umbrella Academy is coming to Netflix, I assume, as a TV show. Yeah, 10-episode series. People may not know, who are not, like, deeply ingrained into the comic book culture, that Gerard Way, the lead singer of the rock band My Chemical Romance, also is famous for doing this sort of cult comic book. Was it Image?
Dark Horse.
Yeah, so it's creator-owned.
Yeah, I love The Umbrella Academy. It sort of got me back into comics.
That's what a lot of people said. It was like a comic book lover's comic.
Yeah, it's pulpy and fun and dark and weird, and I love the artwork. Gabriel Baugh's artwork, he's undoubtedly in my top five like favorite comic book artists of all time. And that being said, I don't know if Umbrella Academy is going to totally translate to a live action thing.
It's pretty like, zany, right? We're talking about like monkeys with like who can talk because they have like things in their brains and stuff like that.
Yeah, and one of the main
people made out of violins. I'm not even sure.
Yeah, one of the main characters has the body of a gorilla, but he's also a space boy. I'm going to give it a chance because mm-hmm. I did love the comic, but I would rather them put out volume 3 of the comic, which they've been teasing since like 2011.
Right. Yeah, he's like kind of like Kevin Smith, where because he has other commitments, he'll like start a series and then like take 2 or 3 year breaks to do other stuff.
It's been more than 2 or 3 years since he announced the volume 3 of Umbrella Academy. He's put out a new My Chemical Romance album. Mm-hmm. He's put out a solo album,
which was surprisingly good, actually. I have that.
It's mm-hmm. all right. He put out another comic that's loosely based off his My Chemical Romance album, The True Lives of the Fabulous Killjoys. And he launched a DC imprint called Young Animal.
I heard about that. Yeah.
Yeah. All of this. And I'm like, just give me more Umbrella Academy. Like, that's all I want from you.
Mm-hmm.
But
well,
yeah.
Maybe now that there's a show and they'll need season fodder, that'll lead him to actually getting off his ass and doing the comic
like,
book.
I think it's taken him longer to release volume 3 of Umbrella Academy than it's taken George R. R. Martin to release the last Game of Thrones book.
Mm-hmm.
And it's back to Game of Thrones, because everything is. It's 2017. anyway, I'll give it a shot. I don't think it's not going to be the same for me, mm-hmm. and that's okay.
The only red flag I would have is, like, Netflix, I don't know, I was just about to say Netflix doesn't necessarily work well in high concept, because I was thinking of Sense8, which has a cult following, but eventually had to be canceled. But Stranger Things is pretty high concept, and that's one of their highest grossing, mm-hmm. you know, highest watched shows. So
it's not even the high concept. It's more just like, to me, the artwork and the stylization go hand in hand with the story.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see how it works with real people, because right. they're so cartoony. And like, if it was a cartoon, I think I'd be more excited, but we'll give it a shot.
We'll see. All right, this one. Todd McFarlane is working on a new Spawn movie through Blumhouse, the small, well, it's not that small. It used to be a small production company. Now it's kind of a little mini major. Horror genre films largely is what they specialize in. Yeah. I guess it's like the 25th anniversary of Spawn or something like that. Somebody made a video about that that I follow on YouTube. I don't know. Do you think there's enough goodwill towards Spawn as an entity for there to be any kind of interest in this? Would they have to update it for today's modern audience? Does it still work?
According to what Todd McFarlane's been teasing this for a long time. Like, this isn't really a news story because he's been a kind of like Umbrella Academy. They've been teasing it and teasing it and teasing it. But apparently, so this is actual news because he finally finished the script and it's gotten associated with Blumhouse. And apparently he wants it to be more horror oriented than like the last Spawn.
Which was more kind of spectacle oriented.
Yeah, he said wants it less to be a superhero movie. He says this new Spawn will be his Jaws and Spawn is the shark.
I don't even know what that means.
Yeah, he said it's going to be like a horror thing where Spawn is more like the a horror movie monster hunting criminals. It sounds very different from the comic. Like, it doesn't sound superhero-y at all. Mm-hmm. So it could be different enough that it doesn't matter that people don't really remember
or care.
But I don't care. Like,
I would be curious. I don't think that Spawn inherently as a thing, as a pop culture entity, has to suck. I know that there are a lot of people, especially people who are not fans of Todd McFarlane as a person for various reasons. Generally are of the belief that Spawn is a big piece of 90s garbage. But I think
that's pretty 90s.
I mean, and but so is Preacher. So is a lot of things. You can look at like any of the kind of like indie, like big indie comic just, hits of the 90s, and it's all very like of that era. And I think that there's a version. Sure.
I'm not going to get into it too much. But it is. He hits a lot of like the anti-hero tropes.
Yes, definitely.
People got very sick of, whereas something like Preacher was a little more outside the box. Anyway, regardless, I think...
My only thing with Blumhouse is Blumhouse is not known for really big movies. One of the reasons their production company is so successful is they don't take huge risks. They you know, back these tried and true sort of genre films, these haunted house movies and stuff. Mm-hmm. They can make them for 20 million or less, and make, you know, triple, quadruple that amount back, even if the movie doesn't even come in number one on its weekend, it can usually make its money back. With a Spawn movie, you're dealing, I know they're going to change the direction or whatever, but with a Spawn movie, you're dealing with all this, like, mythical lore, you're dealing with all of these, like, angels and demons and this kind of stuff. So, I don't know. We'll see, like, the direction they go with it. But I don't know if a $20 million version of Spawn is going to fare well for the material. I'm starting to get kind of like the Punisher Warzone, like, red flags.
Totally could be. I think it depends on how much they've really committed to it being a criminal horror movie versus a sort of superhero movie. So we'll see.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
I don't really care either way.
Okay, I think you will care about this one. Carl Urban is in talks to star in a Judge Dredd TV series.
Yes!
Assume this would be in conjunction with or sort of following the Judge Dredd movie that Alex Garland made.
Yeah, so the talk is that they're calling it Judge Dredd Mega City 1. Mm-hmm. I believe it's... if not directly connected, at least a spiritual successor to the Dredd film. But if Carl Urban is in the talks, then it sounds like it's sort of a direct continuation of it. I'm so down like a clown.
Down with the clown, as the Juggalos say. Yeah, I actually think, you know, another... famous alt comic from sort of the same era. I actually think of all of them, like, this makes the most sense as a TV series.
Yeah.
Like, you could do a version that's kind of like basically NYPD Blue in the future with the Dread Cops.
Absolutely. I mean, Fox sort of did that with Carl Urban with that weird almost human robot, yeah. Which it got canceled very quickly.
One of those, yeah.
Yeah. I'm so into this, though. The Dread movie was a lot of fun. Really kick ass. Mm-hmm. And they did well with a low budget. I think, you could make a cool sci-fi procedural out of it very easily. And if it catches on, you know, get some budget in there and you could get to some of the weirder stories if you get later seasons. But even if you didn't, like, just as sort of a hyper-violent police procedural could be a lot of fun.
Totes my goats.
And Carl Urban was great as Judge Dredd.
Carl Urban is great in general. Every time I see one of those Star Trek movies, I always forget how much I love him as Bones.
Yeah.
He's always my favorite character, by far.
He's a hoot. He is so entertaining in whatever he does.
He's like if Casper Van Dien was good. All right, and this is the last story. Just got announced today. Disney is going to pull all their movies from Netflix to launch their own streaming service. Now, I wonder if this includes stuff like Avengers, stuff like the Marvel stuff.
Oh, 100%. 100%. There's no way they would have enough
Pixar
programming.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guarantee it includes all of the subsidiaries. Star Wars. Yeah. Okay, cool, Disney. This is just a streaming vault. Like, I get it. Disney's always been kind of
weird about their properties.
I was going to say, like, elitist and annoying. Like, the whole vault thing I always thought was annoying. I don't know. I don't really watch that much Disney stuff on Netflix. So, for me, it doesn't really matter. Like, most of that stuff I get in, like, a steelbook format.
Right, or we see it in the theater and whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, so it doesn't really affect me.
It could. I mean, you know, if the trend is moving further and further away from physical media, this might be the only way to see or own Disney stuff after the fact.
I think there's always going to be some kind of a niche collector's market, which that's sort of all I get right now. You can also always purchase them on Amazon. Like, that's always an option. I feel like it's kind of too late to get into the streaming game.
Well, here's my bigger worry, my overarching worry that's beyond just the Disney Netflix thing. Everybody's trying to get into the streaming game. Uh-huh. Everybody wants a piece of that Netflix pie. And so we have all these little niche streaming services popping up. You know, I mean, Amazon's been around for a while. YouTube has one.
Hulu,
CISO, yeah.
Bing Bong.
Zippity Doop. But for real, there's Filmstruck, which is like that. That's the one that has like all of the like arty films and classic films, and the Criterion Collection just pulled all their stuff from Hulu and moved it over to Filmstruck exclusively. And I know that there's that horror one, Shudder, that just launched like last year or year before. So now there's all these little ones, and they're all going to be for their own little niche. And how much longer before Netflix is really only showing original programming?
Probably not too much longer, but you know what? I don't think that they'll ever go like only original, but maybe.
Or getting closer and closer to that.
That's mostly what I watch on Netflix, though.
Yeah, and they're part of the problem. On top of this, so if we have all of these different little niche streaming services like the Disney one or CISO or whatever, who is going to pay like for 14 different streaming services?
No one. That's what I mean. It's getting too late in the game for Disney to suddenly be like, we want you to buy into Stream Diz. I'm like, sorry, Stream Diz. I've got Hulu, I've got Netflix, I've got HBO Now. done. Like, that's all I need.
And that's more than you probably thought you wanted. That's probably more than you thought you would have.
I'm probably going to get rid of Hulu at some point. Like, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's just the market will only support so many before it starts to cannibalize itself.
I think it and already then, is.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Like I said, these new streaming ones pop up and die in a week. Like, but I don't think that's a problem. Because then the ones that survive just end up buying up their properties and still making them available.
Yeah. We'll see. It's an interesting time. I think 5 years from now, when we have a better vantage point, we'll have a better idea of what all of this means and where it's all headed.
Exactly. And this is why if there's a movie that I really, really enjoy, I still purchase a copy of it. Mm-hmm. Whether it's digital or, you know, like some kind of collectible edition, I still get one because, you know, if it's a movie I really like, I want it to be available whenever I want. And if it's, you know, cool runnings or whatever, I'm fine not being able to see it for another 5 years.
Cool Runnings is still in the vault.
No, it's on Netflix right now, but I should rewatch it before it gets
pulled.
Gets pulled to
Disstream
land.
Yeah. All right, cool. So that's the movie news. Kind of did a little bit of a lightning round, kind of not. Let's go ahead. I had a little bit of a pet topic. I wanted to bring this up, mostly because one of the big movies that came out this weekend that neither of us actually watched was The Dark Tower, which is based on the famous Stephen King series, his longest running series.
I'm on book 3 right now.
You're invested. You're actually reading them. Yeah.
Well, I listen to them on audiobook, but I still count that.
That counts. I get the movie didn't do well. Reports say that it was not a very good movie. It had like an 18% on Rotten Tomatoes. Fans were very disappointed. They changed a lot of the things from the book, which happens with almost any kind of film to or book to film adaptation.
Especially one like this. I kind of had a feeling. I feel like just from reading this would also be better served as like a fucking Game of Thrones type series.
Miniseries, like, yeah.
Yeah, like the story's real dense. So I kind of could tell that it seemed like it's going to be a shit show. I still want to see it, just out of morbid curiosity. And I've been sort of like, I was following the marketing for a long time on it. And I am a huge Idris Elba fan, and I've heard that he is sort of the movie's saving grace. So,
and that was literally the only thing that was bringing me in, because I never saw a trailer that did a lot for me. And I didn't know until just recently, but I guess the screenplay was written by Akiva Goldsman, who is the worst working screenwriter in Hollywood.
Yeah, I read that article you posted. He's a hack.
He's literally the worst. It's unbelievable how many failures in a row he's been able to have and still have a job, like doing the high-profile films like this. Yeah, I think Cinderella Man and like The Client, those are like the only things that are like even halfway acceptable. Like, go look up Akiva Goldsman on IMDb and look at his rap sheet.
Anyway,
so this happened. People were really disappointed. So I wanted to do what if you had the power to go in the Wayback Machine or press a button or whatever and be able to just have a complete mulligan on an adaptation or sequel that was a huge disappointment. We can just start over. Let's pretend it didn't happen. Erase everyone's memory, whatever you have to do, and start from scratch. Yeah, what would it be? Your top three.
We can
bounce these back and forth if you want to give me one right now.
Yeah. So my first one was another book series that I read in high school. Most people have read it in high school. There was a BBC adaptation that was pretty fun, actually, but it definitely has a BBC budget. Then the Americans tried to adapt it. I'm talking Disney's Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Pretty disappointing. I feel like it's just totally tonally off.
Yeah.
The movie tries for all this like weird slapstick humor,
mm-hmm.
And loses all of sort of the dry British cleverness.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that I did enjoy was, I believe it was, anyway, he played Marvin the Sad Robot. He was pretty good.
Oh, Alan Rickman. Yeah, yes, he was good in it. Yeah. So Zooey Deschanel was in that for some reason.
Yeah, so was...
Martin Freeman plays a lead character.
Yeah, and I just Martin Freeman, even though he actually is British, mm-hmm. just never sort of clicked with me as the character. And what's his name? Ah, fuck, I'm blanking on people's names today.
Sam Rockwell.
Yeah, I love Sam Rockwell as an actor. I think he's one of the best out there right now. But I just feel like either he was miscast or just sort of just didn't...
Misdirected. I mean,
didn't do what I wanted with that character. So just thought it was kind of a boring turd.
Yeah, it's not very good. I saw that at the Dollar Theater back in our hometown. And
it's just not funny.
It's severely boring.
Yeah.
And it shouldn't be.
No, the book is one of the few books that I like read to completion because I thought it was very clever and very funny. So
yeah, but it is also a very difficult book to translate because it's full of asides. It's full of non sequiturs. It's not really all that narrative. There is a plot, sort of, but it's really just about kind of going from one weird thing to the next.
Also, the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is basically just an iPad.
I guess so, isn't it? Yeah.
It really is.
But so is a Pokedex.
Yeah, it's different. Like, if you read the description of it in the book, it I think it was written in like the 80s or
maybe
late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah.
He basically just describes an iPad.
Hmm.
Sort of weird.
Okay. That's a good one. That's a good one. Mine are fairly basic, and I'm a little embarrassed to admit that, but one of mine is what I thought should have been a very easy to translate to live-action film, and that is the live-action version of Alice in Wonderland that Tim Burton did a few years back, which was very successful, made a ton of money, enough for them to make a really bad sequel. But, the problem is they just didn't even try to do that. They had some weird other plot that had nothing to do with anything. It was kind of a semi-sequel. It was a little bit like Return to Oz meets Through the Looking Glass. And by the end of the movie, for some reason, there's a battle where, like, she's, like, fighting a dragon with a sword, and you just don't know what the hell's going on. She's, like, the savior of Wonderland instead of being antagonized by all these weird things. I just wanted to see Alice in Wonderland. And even like Tim Burton doing it kind of sort of makes sense. Like he could put his artistic spin on it. I'm fine with that, even though the CGI in that movie was atrocious. And it's kind of an ugly movie to look at. Uh-huh. But yeah, I think that you could do a really cool psychedelic, more faithful adaptation of that and even be able to kind of do it in your own way or update it aesthetically however you want. But not that. That was Garbage Town.
That's a good one. All right. My next one is a sequel that it's sort of two sequels that I wish hadn't happened is Prometheus.
Okay.
And subsequently Alien Covenant.
Okay.
Specifically because I just was way more interested in Neil Blomkamp's promised. So I guess all of the Alien movies after Alien 2, Aliens,
mm-hmm.
I wish were a wash so that we could have gotten Neil Blomkamp's sequel to Aliens. And that's essentially what he was proposing to do was let's mulligan the shitty Alien movies and pick it up where people want it.
Mm-hmm.
So the promise of that is what I want.
Yeah. I'm not going to say a ton about that because we just did talk about those movies. So I'll tell people if they're really interested in our opinions on those movies, they should go back and listen to an episode. Like, I think it's like 4 episodes ago, our Alien Covenant review, where we review every Alien movie in the franchise. And we give a lot of opinions about that. But yeah, I was kind of like mildly interested in Prometheus and where it was going to go at the end of it. But they really just screwed the pooch with Covenant, in my opinion. And even the most interesting stuff in Prometheus, they completely disregard and just
mulligan them all.
Yeah.
Mulligan. Let's do something new.
Yeah. I'm bummed out by Alien Covenant. I'm kind of over it. I kind of could never have another Alien movie again and be okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
We got 2 good ones. That's enough.
Yeah. All right. So the other one, this one's a little more obvious. I'm sure you might agree with me. Zack Snyder's Watchmen.
Okay. I was tempted by this. Mm-hmm. I thought about putting this on my list because I do agree with you.
But it's not easy, right? If there's something about it where I'm like, I don't like that movie. I don't like his interpretation of the text, but it is such a faithful adaptation that it's like, doesn't translate. Like, maybe there's something about it inherently that just is never going to work.
Well, the only way that they are turning it into like a miniseries?
Here's what I don't know what that means. We covered that news a long time ago. I'm wondering if that miniseries is going to cover the post-textual stuff, you know, those
don't care,
you know what I'm saying,
instantly turned off.
So I don't know if it's going to be
gone forever.
I actually think it could be a combination of the weird sequel books that DC tried to put out just recently. And
don't even care, just stop talking about it.
And or it's going to be just stories within the universe of Watchmen.
God, you just made me shit my pants.
Yeah, well,
that is how much I don't care about
any of that. I think that's the only way that could have been done well is if it had been a 12 episode miniseries. That seems to make the most sense. And by somebody who's an adult with an adult mind and not a little child boy like Zack Snyder.
Here's the thing: after seeing Zack Snyder's version, I think it could have worked. I think he got close enough to the sun, and to me, that movie falls apart for purely Zack Snyder reasons and not adaptation reasons. So I think that's a good one.
Yeah, it's
the reason I hesitated was A, I knew it would be on your list, and B, I thought we might have some hope with this miniseries thing, but now you just made me more scared.
Yeah, I don't see how that's going to turn out well. I doubt they're just going to disregard
the movie. I thought it might just be a remake, but yeah. I think you're probably right.
Okay, gross. What was your last one?
My last one was also a story by Alan Moore, The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Ooh, good choice. And I think that's so old and like nobody remembers it. It's barely like it's kind of a non-entity at this point.
They could totally redo it.
They could totally do it and nobody would notice.
Yeah, it's a turd of a movie and the book is pretty good. I mean, it's not Alan Moore at his best.
No.
It's kind of pulpy and silly.
Uh-huh.
But not like the movie. It is. It's still pretty smart. And dark as fuck. I mean, you know, Alan Moore.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think they could, like, if they had just sort of stuck to the core story instead of making it this weird not adventure thing that just didn't work. Did Akiva Goldsman work on that? It actually, now that I think about it, feels a lot like
his variety of crap.
Yeah, I have to look that up now.
I don't think so, because I just recently looked at his IMDb, but if it was, I wouldn't be surprised.
Oh, he did do I Am Legend, which almost made my honorable mentions list.
Samesies.
Also honorable mention for Spider-Man 3 and Batman v Superman.
Well, Snyder makes my list twice, because Batman v Superman is my third pick.
Okay. All right.
And the reason it is because more of the systemic damage it's done to the DCU.
Yeah.
I feel like, you know, I was sort of kind of a Man of Steel apologist. Like, I thought the ending was ridiculous and way too much and in bad taste, and I wasn't a fan of the ending, but I thought there was a lot of stuff there that kind of sort of worked and was sort of interesting, turning Superman into this sort of tortured Christ figure or whatever. Like, that's not my favorite thing to do with Superman, but it's a valid way to go with the story, and I thought that it was one of Snyder's oeuvre. It was probably his closest and most successful attempt at emotional storytelling. And then it just totally goes off the rails in the last third. But I thought that, you know, you go from that, which was whatever, you're setting up the universe, and then we never had BV Superman and just went right into Wonder Woman. If that had been the sequel, the next film in the DCU,
oh yeah,
we got an actual universe that you can really start doing something with. Mm-hmm. But instead, they blew their load with Batman v Superman and tried to create a universe out of thin air, and somehow made all the problems with Man of Steel the focal point of entry for what they want to do with their entire franchise. And I feel like I'm just watching with the DCU, with the exception of the Wonder Woman movie, I feel like I'm just watching a slow motion train wreck just happening for the next 5 to 7 years.
Couple things I want to say, and then we'll move on.
Mm-hmm.
One, I totally 100% agree with you.
Mm-hmm.
That movie is pure hot trash.
Mm-hmm.
And taints just about everything to come out of it. Some of my only issues with Wonder Woman were its connection to that movie.
Mm-hmm.
Point number two, I purposely did not put it on my list because I think anybody who's listened has heard me rail on it before.
Yeah, it's almost like if there's a Jabber on the Drone drinking game, that could be one of them.
Yeah, it's possibly one of my least favorite movies of all time. So that I just didn't want to go there again.
Right.
But that's a good pull. It's a good pull.
Mm-hmm.
I wish it didn't exist.
Honorable mentions. I thought about the V for Vendetta movie, going back for the Alan Moore thing. Not because I think that movie's so bad. It's fine, but it's only fine. And it's, you know, based on much better material, but just go read the comic. That's fine. We have a mediocre movie and a very good comic.
I actually maintain that one is still probably the best Alan Moore adaptation. And
damning with faint praise.
Well, sure. I actually enjoy that movie, though.
A lot of people do. It has a weird cult following. I was also on my short list was the Matrix sequels, the Matrix Reloaded and Revolution, which the only reason it's not totally there is because I think there's enough interesting stuff in those movies that kind of save them. They're not anywhere.
And there's some pretty cool action sequences. Yeah, cool if action, nothing else.
Yeah, cool action sequences. Some cool philosophical questions. Blah blah blah. But ultimately, they just they pale so far in comparison to the first one, which is something of like a sci-fi masterpiece. The latter two are just kind of cool action movies.
That's how I feel about Pirates of the Caribbean 3 on.
Yeah.
I really like the first two, but then the third one just got like weird for no reason.
Right, yeah.
Anyway.
Okay, so that was that game. Let's go ahead and get into Atomic Blonde. Why don't you set that up?
Yeah, so Atomic Blonde takes place. Apparently, this also was a comic book adaptation. I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
An undercover agent is sent to Berlin during the sort of the height of the tension of the Cold War, just before the wall fell.
Mm-hmm.
She has to investigate something about a spy list and something about saving a guy. And then there's some crisscrossing, some double talking, some lesbian sex.
And a lot of stylish single track fight scenes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm glad I wasn't, it's sent from the sounds of it. I'm glad I'm not the only one who sounds a little, maybe slightly disinterested / confused about whatever the plot was.
Yeah.
Could you? Could you follow it? I could follow it basically. It's like, okay, there's some MacGuffin they're after, and James McAvoy's there, and he's like, you know, kind of all over the place, and he's a loose cannon.
He's her contact.
Yeah.
He's her initial contact, but he's sort of gone rogue, and she doesn't know how much she can trust him. I mean, I think the basic plot was the same as Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy.
Right.
There's this list of all of the spies' identities that they don't want to get out because then everyone will be in danger or something.
This is literally the same plot as like 1,000 spy movies. This is like the Bourne movies cover this kind of territory. The last few James Bond movies have covered this same territory. This is pretty similar to that Steven Soderbergh film Haywire that came out a few years ago. I mean, this is pretty well-worn spy versus spy stuff.
Yeah, it's plot-wise not, you know, it's not anything.
It's very stock.
I don't know. I didn't hate it, though. I did notice kind of a glaring plot hole.
Okay.
But I kind of can't say too much without getting in this, like, total spoilerville.
Does it ruin the overall effect of the movie, or ruin...
I think it could, so I'm not going to say it.
Okay.
But there was just something... There was something that didn't add up with their movie math to me. Sort of distracted me and took me out a little bit, but
well, it's one of those spy films, and if you've seen more than one of them, you're probably going to be able to guess what happens. But it's one of those double cross, triple cross, and the more you do that, then the more you have to like think about the entire movie and the context of the reveals.
That's
you can't get into it. So there was a plot hole. It may or may not be a problem.
Yeah, I think it is, but I don't know. Yeah, the plot is, like you said, pretty stock. What else? What else did you think about this movie?
Yeah, given that the film is a pretty boilerplate, it's directed by David Leitch, I should say, who was a co-director or an uncredited co-director on the first John Wick film.
Mm-hmm.
Which I mean, I haven't seen those movies, but even just having seen what I've seen of those movies, I can tell there's a little bit of an influence from those to this. He comes from the world of stunt choreography, and he was a stunt actor for a long time in his career. So you can tell the stuff that he's most interested in this film.
But that's okay, because that was what I was the most interested in.
Right. Ultimately, me too. I found myself drifting in and out of interest with the movie as I was watching it. It looks cool. The cinematography is really neat. Everything has this kind of day-glow blacklight look to it. It takes place in the late 80s, so they definitely are, you know, smearing in all of that kind of kitschy pop culture stuff.
I love, like, modern 80s aesthetic.
Yeah, that's sort of the drive / I don't know. I feel there was a lot of carryover influence.
Stranger Things, sure. Like I love the look of
Berlin, like, in the movie.
Just like, this is what the 80s should have looked like, and this is how we all remember it. But then you go back and look at pictures, and you're like, not everything actually did look like this. No, but whatever.
It's highly aestheticized.
Yeah, but that's what I mean. Movie. I enjoy that aesthetic.
Yes, I do too. That kind of, like, especially the, like, this late 80s sort of dark wave look.
Yeah, with the fucking, like, neon lights and
the pulsy, synthy music in the background.
And the guns could basically just be like laser blasters and you wouldn't even think twice.
Right, exactly. Especially another film that came to mind with that kind of lived and died on this aesthetic was a little sci-fi film called Beyond the Black Rainbow, which me and Richard reviewed, and he was less into than I was. Another film which I'd say is sort of all sizzle and no steak, but in this film, my biggest problems with it is I don't really care all that much about the main character. She's barely a human being. She's, you know, yeah. I get that she's kind of like a woman with no name, a man with no name type of thing. But she's so kind of undescript, she's fairly boring. The most human she is in the movie is when she's either fucking or fighting.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's true. And at the start, that was sort of disappointing to me.
Mm-hmm.
But then sort of by the end of it, I was okay with it, actually. Like at the beginning, you know, because I adore Charlize Theron. I think she's... I just think she's great.
I think there's very few people in Hollywood who are having more fun than her right now.
Yeah.
She's really just doing whatever she wants. She's taking lots of risks. And, like, it pays off. Even a movie like this, which I think is ultimately kind of whatever, I think is ultimately, like, she's one of those actresses that if you wanted to have, like, a Halloween theme party and where, like, everybody had to come as a Charlize Theron character, you could do that.
Yeah. Actually, that sounds like really a lot of fun, and I think we should do that for Halloween this year. But, yeah, no, I think exactly, and that's sort of what I get out of this performance, is it is sort of the character's sort of stock action hero, but I was okay with that, because I like movies with those kind of, like, kind of early on in the movie, I was like, oh, okay, this is just an action film.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of let me enjoy it a little bit more. You know, like, again, it kind of reminded me of those, like, this will be on Spike TV or, mm-hmm. you know, TBS movies for guys who like movies.
Sure.
And for that, I'm okay with that. Like, that's not a deal breaker for me. Like, it's, you know, it's not the whole package. It's not a super complex plot.
Mm-hmm.
But the style and the action are definitely good enough to keep me in, like, in the movie.
Sure.
And some of the action sequences are fucking incredible.
Yeah. I mean, that the stunt stuff, especially, that's when I was waking up. Like, there's a lot of that stuff when they're talking about the list and the guy and the girl, and they got to get the thing, and the girl's got to do this, and it's over there. There's a photographer, but we don't know what she's about, blah, 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 blah. Don't care, don't care, don't care. Mm-hmm. Falling asleep. Then we get to that big action set piece on the stairs where she's, like, trying to save her contact.
Yeah.
That is, and it's a real long one take. It's very, very showy, but it's done really well, and it has some of the most, like, physical stuff in the movie. Like, a lot of this feels like it could almost take place in, like, a Blade Runner future. Like, it's Berlin, mm-hmm. but it's very stylized. This felt like you're really in it. This is one of the most, like, painful looking fight scenes I've seen since, like, the True Romance scene with James Gandolfini.
It sort of reminded me of that, I think it was The Protector.
Sure.
Where there's that really long tracking shot where he just, like, mm-hmm. is fighting motherfuckers up the tower. Or is that was that the Protector, or is it
the Raid? No, that's Raid. Yeah, the Raid.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm thinking of the Raid.
Sure.
It kind of gave me that vibe, and I was so into that. It's not, and they actually showed, like, the first part of that scene at Comic-Con.
Okay.
I saw a panel with her, and they talked a lot about the movie. And they showed that, like, the first part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I realized that that was sort of the big climactic action sequence in the movie, I was kind of disappointed, because I was like, oh, I've already seen, like, the really cool action set piece.
Mm-hmm.
But then it just sort of keeps going.
Yeah.
And going. And I'm just like, oh, no, fuck.
They push it to the limit. Well. If there's one thing people will remember from this movie, it'll be that.
Yeah. And I think maybe this movie could have... I would say maybe it could have used a little bit more of that, but I actually don't think so, because when it does explode into action, it's really effective. And I think if the movie had held that level of action, it could have gotten mm-hmm. boring, kind of like Dunkirk.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I do think it was good that it was kind of a slow build to this
right.
just tower of violence.
I get what you're saying, that it's sort of acceptable action schlock.
Yes.
That it's not a great film, but it serves its purpose. And
it kind of reminded me.
This is one of those ones where, like, the further I'm away from it, the more forgiving I am for it. Like, walking out the movie, I was, I'd say, mostly disappointed. But today, I'm like, oh, you know what? I like this about it. I like that about it. And I'm more feeling positive towards it. But I am not also willing to give it a total pass because I think the things to make it even just a little bit better are pretty easy fixes. Even if you want to have her be this icy sort of enigma, I think you could surround her, and they try to do this a little bit with, like, with McAvoy and some of these other people. You could surround her with enough characters who are easier to sort of project something onto.
I could see give her a James friend, McAvoy.
Even her lover, who, what's her name? Because she's kind of in this movie a lot, and she's sort of up and coming. Sophia Boutella. She was in, like, the Kingsman, and she was recently in the Mummy movie.
Yeah,
she's...
Sophia Boutella.
And I thought that was actually some interesting casting, because she's, up till now, been playing, basically, would have been playing the Charlize Theron part in those other movies. And here she's more kind of like this waifish sort of damsel in distress. But you know, given how we've seen her in those other movies, it kind of makes, you know, some of the reveals with her a lot more shocking.
Do you know what I thought when I was watching this movie?
What?
I was like, this is like if La Femme Nikita was directed by the guy who did Smoke and Aces.
Sure. Yeah. Yes. That's a pretty good comparison.
Yeah. So if you like those, I would say
La Femme Nikita is definitely the fingerprints of that influence is all over this, because that's like the same era.
Definitely. And you know, for like a pulpy action callback to that, I was totally into it, and I could watch James McAvoy be a naughty spy all day long.
I have a little bit of Macca beef. With James McAvoy. I think he's really talented. And when he plays these kind of characters, it's very similar to his character in Filth. He looks exactly like fucking Tyler Durden at the end of Fight Club.
He even has the same... Eddie Marsan was in both movies. Right, he sort of tormented them in both.
So maybe I was like vaguely triggered by that because I was not a big fan of Filth.
No, me neither.
But that character, that kind of like... him trying to buck the pretty boy thing. I'm getting tired of it, even though I think he does it pretty well. He does it in no direction is the problem. He's doing a lot of acting, and you know, I can tell like the camera loves him. Like he's a really attractive guy, and he can even do like be a jerk on camera in a really, interesting way. But these characters, whenever he's doing this kind of like balls of the wall kind of crazy asshole characters, I feel like I don't know what I'm supposed to do with all of it. Like you just
watch the train wreck, man.
But I'm not necessarily into the train wreck. I just wish, like, and this is a part of the problem with the direction and the writing of the movie as well. He could have been a more interesting character in the movie. He could have been a more interesting character in all of these kind of roles that I've seen him play recently. With the exception of Split, I think they kind of, there's enough direction there to play with his menace. But this character and the one in Filth and like this kind of like this thing he's doing right now, this phase he's in, I want him to do that thing that he's doing in a better movie with a direction with the character.
Yeah, I don't know. It worked a lot more for me in this than it did in Filth, because I felt like there was like a reason behind it. Whereas in Filth, it's literally like he's just an asshole. He's just a psychotic asshole. And in this, there is like a survival element, and you know, I don't know. I think maybe if you had seen maybe a little more of his character's backstory, and had they not tried to play with the who's double crossing who thing as much, I think it might have played a little better.
Agreed. That's why I said these are the easy fixes. This is just like maybe have a screenplay that's doing a little bit more. Also, like, setting it in, like, East Berlin during the time of the fall of the Soviet Union, I kind of hope that the movie would be about something, and ultimately it's just not.
No, not really. It's more of just, like, a very sort of specific setting.
But I love the soundtrack. You know, yeah, give me cool. give me some Depeche. Give me some Susie. Give me some Lovin' Rockets. I'm all about that late 80s dark wave.
No, me too. Me too. And it feels really cool with the, like, just the shots.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if nothing else, it's a really violent, cool music video.
Mostly.
It sort of reminded me of a female John Wick, but a little more fun. Like, I don't know, this seemed a little more self-aware of its kitsch,
mm-hmm.
whereas John Wick is a little too grim for me. So I was into this more.
Okay. All right. I would say rent it. To me, this is a total renter. Like, you know, or wait to when it's on Spike TV, because it surely will be. Yeah,
but this is like, you know, like a fun Friday night with the boys eating pizza kind of movie.
Hard R, kind of, it's sweaty, it's kind of naughty. It's like, that's what I liked about it. It's just, it feels like, not only like obviously in its aesthetic from another era, but sort of just in its being, it kind of feels like a throwback.
And I think maybe I liked it a little more because of that.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of rated it maybe a little higher because it to me, this was pulling off the promise of the Expendables franchise, if that makes sense. Like, this is more of a throwback action movie versus the Expendables, which is like, is very modern and dumb.
And just poorly made. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So that's that. Did you want to give it a grade rating? For me, it's a C+.
For me, it's hard because I sort of rate that type of movie a little differently because I have a lot of fun watching them.
Different bell curve.
So I would say like a B-.
Okay, pretty close.
Because I did have a lot of fun watching it, so...
Let's get into the Netflix homework. You assigned me Accidental Courtesy, Daryl Davis, Race in America. This is a documentary. It came out last year, probably late last year, because there's some stuff about the most recent election that makes it into the movie.
But Obama is still in office during the movie.
Yeah, but we do see some 2015 footage in there to the race up to the White House.
Yeah.
And it follows the life of Daryl Davis, who is a blues musician who lives in and around Washington, D.C. And he befriends KKK members. He's been around for a long time, and he has this very easygoing personality, and he has this way in where he can just kind of get along with everybody, whether he can connect with them about music or he can connect with them about whatever. He has this gift or this disposition to be able to see the best in everybody and to be able to find the humanity, even when he's talking to people who are trying to strip him of his humanity. And he has he's been successful in getting at least 20 or more high-ranking Ku Klux Klan members to move away from the Klan and actually give him his robes as a souvenir, as well as a lot of other paraphernalia. He has like this whole like museum in his house of KKK stuff. And he's a black man. I mean, obviously that should be said. And so this just kind of follows his life and sort of what he does, you know, both as a musician and mostly as an activist, and him going from town to town and talking to different people.
I think the musician background is more just kind of like, just to sort of give you a little more information about him.
A context.
And maybe how he's able to sort of connect with some of these people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 'cause he is a performer, he's an entertainer.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that probably plays an aspect of how he,
yeah,
he's able to sort of communicate and empathize.
Yes. And I think that it informs a little bit about sort of how he came up. Because I think, you know, when you're in the entertainment industry and you're willing, it's an industry in which compromise comes up over and over and over and over and over again. And I think, you know, just being part of that and you sort of, maybe it's a little easier for somebody from that industry, especially like a black musician playing the blues, to be able to find middle ground with people that you're not like.
And he also talks about how when he was young, him and his family traveled all over the world. Mm-hmm. So he, when he was sort of in his formative years, wasn't exposed to the like day by day sort of casual racism that can happen, you know, to black people in America.
Mm-hmm.
And so that made it, I think, maybe a little easier for him to sort of hear the perspective of fucking Klan members.
Right. And also his role model politically is Martin Luther King, who he follows, you know, very closely, his philosophies about the I Have a Dream speech and that version of the future he hopes to create. And he sees it in a very different way than most people in his communities. There's one scene I think is the centerpiece of the movie.
Yes, I agree. Before you go into it, I was sort of on the fence about this movie until it got to this scene.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Not on the fence. That's overly harsh. But I was more just glad that the movie had this scene.
It's
so that
needed.
We sort of...
Yeah, yes. It's 100%. And, you know, without dancing around it too much, he has a conversation. After we've seen him... This is pretty deep into the movie. After we've seen him talk to a lot of different Klan members, I talked to a lot of different people, some of which are all the way out of the Klan, some of which are only tiptoeing out. And, you know, we think, like, converted, like, oh, now they're just, like, you know, on the front lines of Black Lives Matter and they're just marching along. No, these are people who still are deeply... tied to systemic racism, they're just not extremists anymore.
Yeah, and I think to varying degrees.
Yeah,
I think,
some are further out than others.
Yeah.
But towards the end of the movie, we see him have a discussion with a few young members of Black Lives Matter who are from Ferguson. I believe Ferguson, right?
No, Baltimore.
Baltimore, during a little while after the Baltimore riots. There's been so many riots, can't keep up. A little bit after that, and he's talking to them about it, and they are not having it. Like the centrism is not working for them at all, and it is the most confrontational of any of these that we've seen, any of these interactions we've seen with him with these hardcore races, some of which are still very deep into the KKK and have no plans on leaving. He's able to have, I guess, more congenial conversations with them than we see with these two young men. Now, I'm of two minds of this scene. I think that it's important. I think that those voices need to be heard. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that what they say is even necessarily wrong. I think they have a point of view. The key president of the Southern Poverty Law Center was also sort of on the fence with his approach. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's something to be said about what they say here. I think that the movie frames it in such a way where we only see that juxtaposition is made very clear with like this confrontation with them versus his interactions with these white Klansmen. I think that could have been created. It's a little bit of, I think there's some narrative being created there with editing. Selective footage, that kind of stuff. I'm sure there were plenty of interactions he's had where he wasn't able to convert somebody, or where someone told him to fuck off or to go die or something like that. We don't see that.
Sure.
That's the only reason why I'm of two minds. Otherwise, I think the movie's very important, and I think it's a really good documentary. It's a really good character study of this guy. And I think it's definitely of our times. I think it's a movie that needs to be discussed. There's a lot of questions that it leaves, and I think it's okay if they don't have answers. What do you think?
Oh, you just threw a lot at me. in regards to that one particular scene, I do think it was important because I think it is important to hear a point of view that doesn't agree with his. Mm-hmm. And I actually... I actually saw that scene as sort of seeing a moment where he gets frustrated, and sort of shows that he's not perfect, because I think what the Black Lives Matter movement people are saying to him is valid, but they also, unlike the KKK members, don't give him the chance to talk,
right,
which is interesting. And I don't think the movie is necessarily making a judgment about that, because they leave a lot of this very long, awkward confrontation in.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, we're talking like, I don't even think there's like cuts to close up all that much. Like, you really just see this conversation play out, and it's the most fly on the wall moment of the movie.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't think he necessarily handles the situation great either.
No, he definitely looks flummoxed.
Yeah. And that's what I think is important, is that it's like, to me, the point of this movie is, it's about communicating these issues. It is sort of weird because it portrays these high-ranking KKK members and shows them as very human. And sort of his mission statement is,
don't judge a book by its cover, essentially.
I don't think it's don't judge a book by its cover. I think it's you can't judge until you have, I guess that's sort of the same thing. You can't judge until you've at least heard their side. And that's what I think is sort of the takeaway message. And I think
it's a centrist,
if nothing
argument.
Else, that's what's interesting to me, is seeing sort of the perspective of these people who are involved with something that is literally described as a hate group, right? But they don't talk about hate. They don't talk about...
In these interviews.
Yes, exactly. They do show footage of them, you know, giving their speeches and rallying people and saying some very hateful rhetoric there. But in these interviews, when they're talking about sort of their beliefs, they're presented as people with a perhaps flawed perspective, which is interesting. And I think part of, and again, we're two white people discussing.
I know. So
the
unqualified
issue of race. but I do think real change can't happen without conversation. And that's sort of his mission statement, is I'm going to at least try to talk to you.
A lot of ignorance does come from just exposure. You know, I mean, I've even like noticed this myself, not necessarily for myself, but just in general, just moving from Southeast Idaho, which is predominantly white, predominantly, you know, lower middle class or whatever, to moving to California, and you're just exposed to more people. You're exposed to more people with and different people and different cultures, and it's just, you're just there, and I just think in general more difficult to be racist, because it's just community.
Yeah,
I know that sounds like utopian and kind of like. Corny.
Well,
but the
inverse could be said too, because you know, I think you could also be racist if you were sort of like community adjacent.
Yeah. You know, oh, believe me, there's still plenty of racists here too. In West LA, I've heard some of the most blatant racism of my life.
Oh, I believe it, and it's, I guess this. Again, the point of this movie is just sort of that it is a matter of perspective. You know, these people, while they might say and do monstrous things, themselves are not monsters. They're human beings. And once we sort of restore that humanity, we can hopefully change opinions. You know, opinions can be changed, but I don't know. I'm sort of ranting. Now,
I know. I think I get an idea of what you're trying to say.
Yeah. And it is a tricky situation, and I don't think this guy has all the answers. He, you know, and that's sort of how the movie ends, is he says that he hopes people can do it better than he has. Mm-hmm. Regardless about all the race stuff.
All the stuff the movie's about, yeah.
I mean, my stupid, you know, ignorant, uninformed opinion about it.
Sure.
Not ignorant, but, you know, my
limited
perspective. Yes. The movie itself is, I thought, really interesting. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of interesting history, you know, a lot of interesting history of racism, mm-hmm. Which is something that we don't talk about or hear about a lot.
It's really difficult, you know, to get a clear historical perspective of systemic racism, which was not that long ago. That's the thing that's crazy about this. We think about like the Jim Crow South and like these kinds of things as being like this of, you know, this black and white photo on a wall somewhere. This was like our grandparents. You know, this is like our parents, like specifically we're in our 30s. They can remember a time that is, you know, vastly more dangerous and scarier than even like the most alarming things we see today. That was totally fine and legal, and everyone just thought that was the norm. So like that's kind of why I appreciate his perspective. I appreciate his approach, and I think everyone should do as well as they can, for getting into just the politics, personal politics. I think everyone should do as well as they can in the spheres that they know how. Mm-hmm. But I don't necessarily think that the centrist argument that he brings upon is the cure all, is the final answer, is the only way to go about it.
I don't think it's the cure all, and I think someone says in the movie, mm-hmm. you know, that you have to address the issue of racism on all fronts.
Yes,
like no one
on a macro and a micro scale. He's addressing it on a micro scale. And I think from that perspective, it's really easy to say, hey, guys, let's have a conversation. Whereas those guys in Black Lives Matter who are literally on the front lines while their police are shooting at them or doing whatever, gassing them and, you know, all of the rest of it. It's really hard from that vantage point to say, let's just get along.
Yeah. And we see that. Mm. We see their opinion and what happens. And again, I think that you cannot discount or invalidate their anger, mm-hmm. Their anger towards him and his approach. You know, they don't want to hear his reasoning behind it. Mm-hmm. And I get it. But I also don't get it, you know, mm-hmm. like I can't get it. I will never understand that in my life. What, you know, what a lot of people have to go through.
Right.
A lot of black people specifically.
Right. To be in fear of your life just for being who you are. Like, you have to always be on guard and think about, where am I? You know, what do I say? How do I dress? These are things that, like, me and you specifically, for the most part, don't have to worry about.
No, I don't have to worry that if I get pulled over, you know, this could be it for me. Mm. And the sad reality is that some people do.
Yeah.
And for some people, they get murdered. Like, it's that. Anyway, I think this movie, this documentary, is really good at pointing a lot of this out, giving a lot of interesting information about history that we don't normally get. You get to hear a lot of the Ku Klux Klan's cartoonish ranking names.
You like do get that.
Wizard and dragon.
Mm-hmm. Cyclops.
Yeah. And you get a little bit of... Yeah, Cyclops. What the fuck? And you get some music history. So I definitely think it's at least, like you said, worth watching and worth talking about.
Yeah, I think it's major accomplishment as a documentary is that it sparks conversations that definitely need to be had right now. And you know, I think the way I feel about this movie would have been very different before the outcome of the election than after. And I think both opinions that I have about the movie of, you know, if I am of two minds are, I'm glad that I saw it to be able to experience either of those opinions. I think it's a must watch documentary, no matter where you are on the political spectrum.
I agree. And it's really well done.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think we solved racism.
It's over. Soon as I upload this thing to Podbean, it's just going to like come like a rainbow wave over all of America, and we'll be good.
Maybe we should have watched this like
next week for the Netflix homework. I'm going to have us go back in time. We're going to be watching the classic film Sunset Boulevard, which has been turned into a musical. It's been turned into a lot of things. It's been parodied half to death, but is one of my personal favorite films. What else? Why don't you do some promotion? What do you want people to see this week?
Tonight in San Diego is on a break again.
Mm-hmm.
I'm taking a month off. You can go back and watch our videos online on Facebook, on YouTube. Tonight in San Diego, check it out. Follow me on Twitter at Keith Foster Kid. Follow me on Instagram at Keith Foster Kid. That's it for now.
Okay, that's enough. You can follow me at BC Cassidy, V as in Victor, CCASSIDY. BC Cassidy is my Twitter. You can also find us, the show, at Jabber Podcast. And if you want to see all the news stories we don't cover, you want to be able to see when we post new episodes on Facebook, go to facebook.com/JabberPodcast. You can also follow me as a writer, film critic. I do the movie reviews for the Idaho State Journal. I'll be writing a review for Atomic Blonde here in the next couple days. I have my Dunkirk review up at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. I also was a semi-contributor to the Seattle-based entertainment site MacGuffin at mcguff.in/Cassidy/author/Cassidy. And we have friends who also do podcasts that you should be listening to, including Patrick at Make Dad Read Comics and Almost Educational. And we talked about comics and politics. So either of those topics would have been on either of his podcasts or both.
Yeah.
And you, at some point, Keith is going to be a guest on Make Dad Read Comics. So when that happens, we'll let people know.
Oh, it's already happened. I already told you we've been hiding Easter eggs.
Yeah, you're leaking it out slowly. There's a whole marketing campaign behind this episode. And Rod and Denise at the Listening Party, you should go back and listen to their latest episode. And I think they're teasing, I'm not sure, but if you listen to the last episode, they teased a couple times that they might be ending. So I don't know. I hope not. I don't know what they're trying to say.
Wait, what?
Yeah, go back and listen to the last episode. There's a couple, like, teasy teases about them coming to an end or something like that. So I hope that's not right. I'm against this officially.
Yeah.
I will riot over the end of the Listening Party if they do that. So please don't.
Don't do that. Also, check out Blizzlet.
Blizzlet, that's your friends who do the Hearthstone podcast.
Yeah, they need to put it on Player FM because I haven't listened to it. I also don't play Hearthstone, but I'm sure it's good if you're into that.
Yeah. I think that's their tagline on iTunes. I'm sure it's good if you're into that. Denise's solo podcast, The Mascot Diaries. I think that'll probably be going on for a little while, even if they do decide to shut down Listening Party, which I hope they don't. But that's the show, and we'll be back next week or the week after, depending how movies work and our lives. And
things might get crazy for me pretty soon, but we'll see.
Until then, we'll see you at the movies, giving it to Gosling.
Bye.